Bienvenidos a Ley Foro Cripto Derecho, un programa donde discutimos las intersecciones entre el derecho y la tecnología blockchain. Este podcast ha sido traído gracias a la Comisión de Tecnología del Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico. Las opiniones vertidas en este episodio son exclusivamente de los partícipes, no representan necesariamente las opiniones del Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico ni constituyen asesoría legal. Para comentarios, sugerencias o auspicios, puede contactarnos escribiendo a podcast@capr.org o visitando tecnocaapr.org. Saludos y muchas gracias nuevamente por acompañarnos en este, el podcast oficial del Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico. Le habla el licenciado Andrew Mercado Vázquez, presidente de la subcomisión sobre blockchain, que es parte de la Comisión de Tecnología del Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico. En el día de hoy nos acompaña la arquitecta Jillian Crandall. Ella nos va a estar abundando sobre lo que sería pues, la blockchain y el impacto de blockchain desde un punto de vista distinto, desde el punto de vista de una arquitecta que está entonces involucrada en estos temas. Así que le damos la bienvenida y claro, para que todo el mundo esté al tanto, este episodio va a ser en inglés, pero posteriormente vamos a estar publicando una revisión en español donde vamos a estar cubriendo los puntos más importantes para que todos tengan acceso al material. Así que ahora le damos la bienvenida a la arquitecta Crandall. Jillian, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for accepting our invitation to talk about something that's probably out there, you know, talking about blockchain and how we use that technology from an architectural point of view or from an architect's point of view. So we know that you're a registered architect, you're a PhD student, but just bring us up to speed of what you've been doing most recently, what you're looking into.
Right. Well, thanks so much for the invitation. Yes, you're right. I'm a registered architect, PhD student in geography at the University of California, Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And recently, my research and consulting practice really focuses on civic tech equity for urban and rural communities, mm-hmm. and particularly for those communities for whom the digital divide is really felt most strongly. And so I've been researching cryptocurrencies and blockchains since 2017, mm-hmm. Primarily focusing on like the social, spatial, material, and political implications of blockchains on like land, on housing, as well as smart contracts to urban governance and broader digital geographies. But I also do have a blockchain certification in the University of Buffalo. So I also dabble in the technical code fundamentals of smart contracts as well. So wow. I'm trying to get a little bit of everything.
So there's an intersection there that at least I don't hear about too often. And this being a podcast from, you know, more or less the legal environment, we do always want to bring on voices that allow us to view the issue, not from a purely legal point of view, but still something that probably people would consider important either way. So the way that you kind of address this space, how did that come about? Did you just stumble on blockchain? Was it something that you discovered as you studied something in particular? What happened that you suddenly entered this strange little intersection?
Right. No, you're so right in that the intersection between the humanities and social sciences and policy and the legal aspects mm-hmm. around blockchains are so important. And that intersection has been something that's very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. In 2017, I was doing my master's in the New School with mm-hmm. Maya Wiley, working on tech equity projects. At the same time, I was working full-time with my architecture firm on hurricane recovery projects, actually mm-hmm. in Puerto Rico. And when I was out there, just realizing a real heightened attention to digital technology for economic development. At the same time, you have likely heard about the phenomena of establishing a crypto utopia in Puerto Rico.
Of course.
And the evolving, at the time was Act 20 and 22, now Act 60. Mm-hmm. And speaking with some of the tech expats there, as well as locals, trying to figure out what is going on and what is a more equitable direction. That's really what got me started in researching blockchains. I never really came to it on my own fruition, but alas, here we are.
Well, it's amazing that Puerto Rico had, you know, to a certain degree, a role in you discovering that. And in the spirit of full disclosure, you and I co-authored a paper titled Cooperativism as Contestation to Crypto-Colonialism in Puerto Rico. So you're on the record basically to address these issues that are just starting really to manifest themselves. Where do you think, or what is it exactly about these issues? And especially when we're talking about terms like crypto colonialism, what's the importance of that from a broader point of view, as you mentioned, policy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it, at the end of the day, comes down to whose land for whom, mm-hmm. right? And it's a broader question of, in economic development terms, we understand why there might be a push towards incentivizing more digital technologies and, mm-hmm. and development, because it's not same necessarily, it's not subject to, for example, the Jones Act, mm-hmm. extra taxation on exports of physical goods. Mm-hmm. So we kind of understand that. But in terms of equity focus on geographies and place mm-hmm. and space, that's really my perspective. And I think collaborations with existing groups on the ground, people who are experts, you know, mm-hmm. yourself in legal terms, I don't have necessarily the body, the education, the body of knowledge around legal acts in Puerto Rico. So I have the privilege of stepping back a little bit and being able to review broader case studies across the globe and spending kind of the academic research time around this. Mm-hmm. And that it is a privilege, honestly. It takes a lot of time when a lot of people could use that time in other directions.
Now, do you find that you are you're finding within the academic space more and more academics or other types of individuals that have similar focuses being drawn to these subjects, or do you think this is still out in the fringes?
I think we're seeing more and more of it every year. Mm-hmm. Honestly, being paid more close attention to it in critical studies in the digital humanities mm-hmm. and in geography. So there is an emerging academic field called critical blockchain studies, and that comprises social scientists as well as some computer engineers. We're looking at, you know, better policy recommendations just outside of necessarily the technical computer science direction. And I think it's really important because we see blockchains influencing more and more of our daily lives, mm-hmm. sometimes in opaque ways. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, blockchain is it claims to be so transparent and open, but sometimes the things that are getting rolled out are being done without most citizens' knowledge. And that could be concerning. Right?
Well, From the legal point of view, attorneys and general practitioners of the law, they usually operate within the space where the language utilized is itself a barrier that for some people is insurmountable, because you have to just suddenly tackle and become familiar with concepts that otherwise you wouldn't use as just in your daily life. Do you find that that's a problem in the blockchain space? And if so, do you think that is just an incidence of how tech heavy it is? Or do you believe that it's more it's a development of just people within that space not taking into account the value or any need to have others, you know, participate?
Right. I do think blockchain specifically comes with a lot of buzzwords mm-hmm. and the rhetoric. And in my research, I like to look at what's actually being developed in practice empirically. Mm-hmm. What do we actually see blockchain being proposed for or used for? And is it being used in a truly democratic way, right? So many projects do claim to use blockchain in a democratic way, but you have to pull back and question the rhetoric or the buzzwords that mm-hmm. actually sound good, but may mask anti-democratic processes, right? And evaluate if the project adheres to certain ethical frameworks and can hold up to democratic principles, right? And so I could also step back mm-hmm. and talk about in the kind of the eternal debate in digital technologies from an academic perspective, mm-hmm. in science and technology studies, there's a school of thought which stems from Langdon Winner, who argues that certain technologies have inherent politics that cannot be separated from their original intent, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, nuclear power, not only was it a war technology used for mass destruction, for electrical power, it requires centralized systems with central facilities, technicians, securities. So some people would argue that because of those inherent politics, nuclear technologies are fundamentally incompatible with democratic processes. So in my research, I often scratch my head about this, and I question over the last 6 or 7 years since I began studying blockchains, right, and their social, technical, material implications. Mm-hmm. What are the inherent politics of blockchain, right? So we all know that, you know, Satoshi's Bitcoin white mm-hmm. paper stems from the cypherpunk movement, cyber libertarian ideology, celebrating free market, you know, more privacy and anonymity, also calling for a return to the gold standard. But, you know, given blockchain's initial ties with cyber libertarianism and then later speculation, extraction via crypto, mm-hmm. theoretically, we have to ask, is the underlying blockchain technology even compatible with certain democratic processes? Mm-hmm. And so from here, this is where we have to parse out that rhetoric that we were talking about. What's inherent to cryptocurrency specifically, and then what's inherent to the underlying digital architecture of blockchain, right? And this starts to emerge under mm-hmm. Vitalik Buterin, you know, with Ethereum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the way that I define it and the way that I try to wrap my head around it is that at the end of the day, a blockchain is simply a cryptographically secured digital distributed ledger or database that accounts for transactions and exchanges. So technically, it's really more boring than most people want to admit. But that's okay, right? You know, because then we can look at the technical architecture of the digital tool to determine if it's the right tool for the job. And so that's where I think we'll talk about in a minute, the really interesting piece for cooperatives, because we can look at how a blockchain or a decentralized distributed ledger can possibly reduce costs or increase efficiencies, right? And then particularly a reduction in time intensive labor if certain actions are automated by smart contracts, right? We can talk about that more in a bit. But,
we're definitely going to talk about that, but I just want to, I would love to hear you or your opinion on what you mentioned earlier about that there's certain policies or certain policy-like thoughts or developments that are just a result of the technicality of a technology. Do you think that in the case of blockchain, that you mentioned the cypherpunks, you mentioned Satoshi, you mentioned that ideology of you know, the government's out to get us. Let's make sure that they can't, and then let's try to live our lives from a decentralized point of view. Do you think those thoughts had that level of effect on the technology, like the example you said earlier of nuclear technology? Is blockchain something that we can't unscrew from the ideology of the cypherpunk movement, or is it free floating and we can just go ahead and move in and affect it from a political point of view?
Right. Can we decouple it from its initial?
Yeah. What's your thoughts on that?
I actually do go back and forth on this, but fundamentally, I do think what's interesting about blockchain specifically is that certain narratives, particularly around decentralization and distribution, mm-hmm. have not only attracted people on the cyber libertarian right, but also mm-hmm. on the political left, right? Okay. So people looking to break up tech monopolies specifically, mm-hmm. right? And so I do think that there is a contradictory political aim that certain groups are leveraging the what is called, right, the disruptive nature of blockchain to experiment in new ways. And that's kind of exciting.
Okay. We're not at the point yet that we can call that out, perhaps, or maybe we're just before something that can serve either way, I think. So that's at least my point of view. I really do think that it can serve either way, which brings us to the main discussion in and also more or less what we wrote about on that paper, cooperativism as contestation to cryptocolonialism in Puerto Rico. More broadly speaking, you know, utilizing this technology in such a fashion where certain groups with ideals that might be more akin to, you know, social values and things of that nature can utilize this technology. One of the things that we might be talking about is the element of decentralization. So what, how can blockchain technology kind of enable maybe like a cooperative to operate in a decentralized way, which might then reduce costs, as you mentioned earlier? Is there something concrete that maybe we should take into account if we try to build that type of structure?
Yeah, I do. And I think that in our paper, we also heavily emphasize the idea that we're not trying to start from any one technology itself to build a project, and specifically to build a cooperative project. Rather, we're starting from principles of cooperativism.
Right.
We're starting from democratic principles and the ownership, operation, and maintenance structures, kind of planning this out before we code anything down. So I think for co-ops that are interested in learning if blockchain technology makes any sense, right? We're out the gate starting from seven principles from the International Cooperative Alliance, right? And I think from here, some of these principles kind of guide the direction, and we can evaluate whether it's compatible with the technology. So the decentralized aspect is really interesting for us, particularly to enhance some of the perhaps weak points in cooperative organization outside of utilizing any digital tools. And I think too, on the other hand, we want to develop best practices, like looking at certain case studies and some of the challenges that they might have faced. So one of the challenges is that really there have only been a very few implemented blockchain co-op projects, one being the Faircoin or Fair Co-op case based in Catalonia, which already has a strong history of cooperativism. We can talk more about that in a bit. But, you know, had some great successes, but also some challenges. But then there's also the Colony project, which claimed to be a digital commons, but upon closer analysis of their technical protocols and priorities and values, we found that it doesn't pass the test of alignment with the seven cooperative principles, particularly because it fails the social responsibility test. Also, its voting model is based on the more tokens you own, the more voting power you have. So we can talk more about that in a bit, but I would say using blockchain has some potentials in interlinking with other technology movements around the globe. So particularly the platform cooperativism movement is really gaining momentum. And that's more about creating digital platforms with collective ownership and governance by and for the workers. And I think these end up being quite diverse, right? They can be alternatives to venture capital funding. They can be cooperatively owned online marketplaces. And for these, you really need to scale up and expand beyond just a central group, right? You need to actually engage in some decentralized mechanisms. And I think part of the issue is that a lot of platform co-ops are focused on like rendering services, not necessarily goods, but it could be used for that as well, right? And I think that in Puerto Rico particularly, there might not be many tech-focused co-ops in development at the moment, but there are a lot of startups that are focusing on digital services that could benefit from engaging in this wider cooperative network, right? Like art creators, music creators, clothing manufacturers, right? These could all connect to a wider audience. And I think the network could be other local co-ops in Puerto Rico, or it could the benefit of the distributed ledger or a blockchain is that it can scale up and connect to other co-ops, either in the diaspora or outside the archipelago. And so specifically, what are the benefits of decentralization and of blockchain, right? So I think in the case of like affiliated co-ops, right, it would be feasible, as we looked into, it would be feasible to place their supply chain on the same blockchain, right? Because most businesses do business with the same suppliers. They also could share an accounting ledger, right? And this system could be updated continuously with the transactions. And that automates certain labor, right? And then the network also could possibly benefit from creating a co-op stablecoin. And that could be used or redeemed at other co-ops for any other goods or services. And so with that, you have this interoperability built into the network and essentially cooperation between co-ops.
Exactly. Right? One of the main principles.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And then like lastly, too, in terms of efficiency, I think all co-ops currently have to send financial reports right, to regulating agencies on a pretty regular basis. And so those reports could also be generated automatically through smart contracts with the use of the distributed ledger. And so all in all, the time, the effort spent on working on those mundane clerical tasks could then be used for other productive purposes. Now, setting this up in the first place might take a lot of time, you know, technically to make sure you do it right, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But hypothetically, once you code it correctly, it's a bit more smooth sailing.
And I find it interesting how the aspect of decentralization that's touted so often as the one of the main factors, for example, for Bitcoin to kind of be considered digital gold and for no one to be able to interfere with it, quote unquote. Of course, no one being able to interfere with it. I mean, that's not a subject of today's episode, but anyone can look up exactly what it would entail, and that idea of decentralization for Bitcoin kind of becomes more and more hard to defend. But it's interesting how we can take a concept like decentralization that's so central to that school of thought of, you know, libertarianism, and utilize it for just pretty much the other side of the coin, which is trying to take a bit of the burden from running these projects, these co-ops, and apply this technology to be able to run those other aspects in a more cost-efficient way, which would allow the cooperative to probably invest more of their time and effort and resources into the actual act, whichever it is that the cooperative is focusing on. Now, from decentralization, we can then kind of start thinking about transparency and accountability. And I think maybe those concepts are a little bit more directly akin to this type of organization that we're just imagining.
Yes.
What's your take on that?
Yes, yes, exactly. I think, again, here we have to be critical or precise about what we mean when we say that blockchain is immutable and reduces the need for third parties, right? Or is fully transparent and secure, just for the same reasons you were mentioning, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. Because of the cryptographic protocols, it often is technically more secure, but there's usually always a third party somewhere, right? Whether it's the exchange that you use or even the digital wallet that you use. So ultimately, it's not a trustless technology. Mm-hmm. And we've seen time and again how these exchanges get hacked.
Right.
And so you do have to place your trust in something, right? And it just means that you would do well to know exactly who you're placing your trust in, who's building these wallets, who's building these exchanges, like who has control of that. And then as far as transparency goes, I think there's also many types of blockchains, depending on how they're permissioned, that are not always transparent, right? So for example, private or permissioned blockchains are only accessible to a select few people. And maybe that's the way you want to run it, right? Maybe not everybody needs to see everything and they just kind of trust that the people behind the scenes are doing the work, and that's fine. But it's just, it's good to know that there's different types out there. And I think though, with the right technical application, blockchain can act as a fairly tamper-proof ledger of transactions. And it does have the ability to like increase certain openness and accountability. especially if you more or less trust the people in your cooperative network. But right. here it's written on the ledger. It's there. You can trace it back. And in traditional cooperative structures, records and functions like proof of membership or voting records or rules or rule changes, those policies and proposals and even mm-hmm. voting mechanisms, those can all be written and documented on the blockchain and provide a decentralized record or history of mm-hmm. legal and administrative procedures and changes over time, which is technically distributed or shared across the computers of the members on the network, right? So this changes the co-op structure of one that's generally pretty centralized, right? With maybe like one yeah. or two appointed record keepers with sometimes a physical book on their desk or paperwork kept somewhere in a room, yeah, or maybe yeah. for those who are more digitally advanced, like saved on their hard drive somewhere, yeah. right? But that goes down, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And so on a blockchain, these records could be kept on this decentralized server or distributed ledger that's shared by all of or many of the members of the co-op on the network. And so then you could also ask the alternative question, well, like, couldn't we do the same thing on a shared server or a Dropbox or Google Drive or right. Discord, right? That all our members have access to. And yeah, the answer is yes, but in some cases, those files could be erased accidentally or even intentionally tampered with. I mean, also it's Google or Dropbox or Discord, right? Right? So you have to place your trust in that as well.
Talk about centralization.
Exactly. So, but on a blockchain, if that's set up correctly, you kind of have ownership of that in your own control, depending on what blockchain it's built on. And it could reduce, in some ways, it could reduce errors and corruption technically and improve accountability. So there is some utility to that.
There's definitely some, I mean, the way that I think about this issue is it just allows anybody that, well, according, taking into account whatever the cooperative is trying to do and what they're trying to put on the blockchain, but whatever's on the blockchain is available to basically anybody that has access to it. Mm-hmm. So I kind of think that that's an element that cooperatives sometimes suffer from. It's just that they're usually organizations that aren't very large, so they don't have a bunch to put into, getting the word out about what their services are. You know, sometimes they just do rely on that area in which they're in, their immediate community. But having the ability to get these activities, these cooperatives, into a network that can be accessed from anyone in any point might be one of those factors that can drive them more and more into just, you know, becoming a integral part of their community and people becoming aware of their existence, right. Which then kind of leads me into the more dollars and cents side of things. Like, can blockchain technology maybe provide cooperatives with new ways to access funding or to generate some sort of working capital so that they can, you know, maybe issue a token, as you said, or maybe utilize this as a way to generate some type of digital good?
Right. Yes. Yes. I think historically, one of the largest challenges for the cooperative community is accessing capital and mm-hmm. finding initial investment. And I think blockchain proposes a solution to this, mm-hmm. particularly via crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a few projects emerge these days, but primarily allowing people to invest directly through web-based platforms mm-hmm. with built-in legal compliance via smart contracts.
Right.
And so there's a few interesting things that are happening now in more accessible financing options. One is the security token offering, mm-hmm. which tokenizes real world assets like fractionalized shares in real estate, for example.
Yeah.
And there's one project called Equity Chain based in New York, which is trying to use security tokens to crowdfund more affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And so right now they're not looking at housing cooperatives as a model, but technically that would be compatible with their goals and that could be really interesting. The thing is, under most blockchain REITs, mm-hmm. Real estate investment trusts, legally, you have to be an accredited investor, right? A qualified yeah. high net worth individual to buy in. But now under Reg CF, also known as Title III crowdfunding.
Okay.
This removes certain barriers and opens up who can invest. So there are investment limits, of course, you know, to limit risk to people who haven't done this before. But and I do believe it's now restricted by the SEC to about $2,500 a year. There's a whole calculation, so don't quote me on that. But that's if you're not an accredited investor. There's also a total fundraising cap for projects. I think the aggregate amount is now something like $5 million of total securities. But you can check out all the latest limits through the Code of Federal Regulations. And I think most fintech, like financial tech crowdfunding entities recently have been established as Delaware corporations.
Of course.
And they do this because it's good for those managing the entity. But if you're just a member, it's something to watch out for, because Delaware corporations allow the manager of a limited liability company to disclaim all fiduciary responsibilities to the members. And most other states do not. But this is what we see. We see a lot of Delaware corporations lately. And bringing it back to cooperatives, specifically under PR law, Puerto Rico law, is co-ops can issue preferred shares, which are considered part of the capital of the co-op and can never exceed a certain amount or the total amount of issued common shares, right? So the income obtained from those preferred shares are exempt from the payment of income tax, right? Pursuant to state laws. So those shares could be tokenized and you have some utility there. But, and a big but, is that the right measures have to be put in place to prevent speculation of the token, right? Which is what we saw with the ICO boom. You really want to implement a consensus mechanism that prevents mining, right? Which is incredibly energy intensive, for one. So optimally not proof of work, really anything other than that. I mean, proof of stake is a bit more energy efficient, but the issue with this is that transaction confirmations are done by the computers of the users who own the most tokens.
Right. And that
they have
runs
more
against
stake in the network. Right. So it's maybe not so bad if you trust those members, but you just want to make sure it doesn't become an oligarchy, right? And I've been researching some interesting alternative precedent models for consensus mechanisms. One of those is what was used in the Faircoin or Fair Co-op case in Catalonia, where they developed a mechanism called proof of cooperation. And I really would recommend looking more into this on the Peer-to-Peer Foundation wiki, but essentially proof of cooperation does not have mining functionality. Instead, they have what are called certified validation nodes, which cooperate with each other rather than compete against each other to secure the network. And so in order to become one of those nodes, Faircoin has a type of vetting process that is intended to protect its economy from, you know, bad actors like hackers or speculators. And the underlying block creators, these cooperatively validated nodes, they have to be approved by the Faircoin, Fair Co-op Assembly. And this is a network of, at the time, had about 280 Faircoin users that were responsible for making decisions, right? Ensuring their ideological commitment to the project. So essentially, it's like an elected co-op board, right?
Yeah.
Very familiar.
Basically.
And then that algorithm works, interestingly, as a way to create the next block. So each node approves the next node by digitally signing their data, which contains the unique ID. Then after they receive all the necessary signatures, it takes those pending transactions, forms a new block, then it's stored in the database for everybody to see. And there's also no large rewards for creating the block, besides a small fee that's awarded to the block creators just to compensate for the energy and bandwidth costs of running that validated node. But they said somewhere like it only uses the amount of energy is like two light bulbs. So comparatively a lot more energy efficient than especially proof of work.
That's fascinating because you're mentioning basically a consensus mechanism, as we mentioned before on the podcast, which is a way for nodes or the participants in a distributed ledger to be able to basically coordinate or agree upon what the correct version of the distributed ledger is. So with Bitcoin, it's incredibly computer intensive because it's a challenge, basically. It's this mathematical challenge in which you just have to brute force it with just immense amount of CPU energy to be able to just reach this very specific number or result of computation to be able to then gain the right to basically add the next block. But what you're mentioning is something that's just 180. It's how do we cooperate as nodes to get this ledger in such a way that everyone can trust it? And that's fascinating because it basically allows us to understand how blockchain can function as a platform upon which we can build consensus mechanisms, upon which we can build these digital structures that project or that reflect the values that we're trying to instill upon them. So that consensus mechanism, it would be useless to someone that wants to build something like Bitcoin, right?
Right.
But it would not be useless at all for someone that wants to put up a cooperative and have some sort of, some sort of basis for that cooperation to be more transparent and attract investment. Because just at the end of the day, these are still going to be organizations that need funding somehow to start, to get started. So that's fascinating. What about on the dimension of governance? You mentioned, I don't exactly remember what we were talking about earlier, but you did mention about the level of transparency. You talked about how we can, address the issue of trust. So governments, does blockchain technology, does it facilitate decision-making or allow for some more efficient voting structures or consensus building, in your opinion?
Yes. And I think it gets back to the concept of scale again, right? So some critics of platform cooperatives specifically, they argue that, okay, you can create an impressive local project that might locally at a small scale be able to beat certain monopolies like Uber, right? If this is a cooperative ride sharing
In your neighborhood
mechanism, right? In your tiny neighborhood, right? But they just cannot scale up to compete with monopolies globally. But one of the proposed benefits of using distributed ledgers or blockchains in cooperatives is that it does allow cooperatives to scale up and to connect across wider geographical distances. Mm-hmm. But I would caution, we're not aiming for like limitless growth, but as we mentioned before, cooperation amongst other cooperatives that have principles that align with each other, right? So this aligns with more of a federation model, mm-hmm. right? That includes establishing a network of distributed cooperatives in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. maybe locally on the archipelago and in the diaspora in the mm-hmm. United States or in other countries.
Right.
And like we're doing today, right? Using Zoom or other web conferencing softwares, this allows co-op meetings to happen without necessarily having to be in the same physical room. And so other improvements in digital technologies, I think, could intersect with the distributed ledger, mm-hmm. but particularly for blockchains in terms of like member voting, mm-hmm. voting can happen at a distance. It's recorded on the ledger. So ultimately, co-ops can engage and connect with members in new ways. I think that increases participation for some without that barrier of physically being present in the same location. With this, you can govern a co-op more remotely and reach new audiences, new groups of people who are looking mm-hmm. to join a community with these shared social, cultural, or economic goals.
Right.
But on the other hand, the risk of scaling up so large is that the organization might tend to become a little bit impersonal, right? Because you might not ever mm-hmm. get to meet or get to know all of the members in your cooperative if it gets so big. And there's a risk in that in terms of consensus building, right? So something that makes small local co-ops so successful is because generally everybody knows everybody. And when disagreements happen, people can debate it, usually in a civil manner. Sometimes it gets heated, But I think with that discussion then removed from face to face, and if it's happening behind the keyboard, sometimes people forget that there's real humans behind the screen, and that gets a bit scary. And what I was mentioning before with the Faircoin or the Faircoop case, it's usually used in academic literature as a case study of how distributed ledgers can be created, owned, and operated by co-ops, like by the people, for the people.
Right.
But its implementation and its management faced a lot of challenges. Right. So first of all, it faced significant pricing challenges, and there were arguments amongst its members that they just had irreconcilable differences in that decision making that caused the platform to fork. And so now we really don't have one direct place to go, and that's a real issue. And then I think just ongoing challenges of this implementation, it's a complex technology, especially to do it right. And there's a lot of uncertainty around this that contributes to maybe an overall lack of users because they're just not familiar with it at this juncture. We're kind of early days here.
Yeah.
And I think if we know that, I would love to see more projects utilizing the proof of cooperation mechanism. I think that's something that we really learned from and great success.
Yeah.
But we also know that any co-op that decides to embark on this is going to be pioneering, right? Challenges are definitely to be expected. You might want to even welcome the challenges because it's these debates that direct a more equitable future, right? So we do need more experimentation and more sandboxing within and directed by cooperatives, right? That's the first step. And then we also mentioned, I think you mentioned the process of voting using blockchain.
Yeah.
Another thing to watch out for, I alluded to it before, is the scaled voting, right? Like the Colony project that equated the number of votes you get with how many tokens you own, right? That's just inherently anti-democratic and antithetical to cooperative principles, right? So we have to make sure that an ethical co-op DLT runs on a system of one vote, one person.
Right? Absolutely agreed.
You know, so then if you start to scale up, then the issue becomes, well, maybe not everybody wants to vote on every issue. So what happens there? Some DLTs that are interested in co-op organization, they propose to kind of electively abstain from voting or letting users kind of allocate their voting token to a trusted member. It's kind of like electing a co-op board, right? And it's something similar to Faircoin's proof of cooperation, at least their consensus protocol, but it could technically work in a number of different ways as long as it's democratically determined. And so in many ways, right, the design of the values and the principles, again, I'm just saying it time and time again, those need to lead first, and then that technology or how you code it should come second.
Right. I mean, we're already seeing like some states that, and this is a different subject, but talking about how that can be handled, there's some states that already have DAOs that can operate under the structure of LLCs. But what's interesting is that these states that are approving that legislation, they require the smart contract to be reversible.
Yes.
So maybe what you're talking about of delegating your vote maybe to a group of people, maybe that wouldn't be it's so difficult to reconcile if we add that element of to be able to revert that delegation at any point whenever the member feels like that by doing it.
I think building in a certain degree of flexibility and negotiation is really critical, right? I think the idea of immutability, when it works to kind of prevent either co-optation or a kind of hacking the system, that makes sense. But to be so rigid to not be able to reverse mistakes that might have been made, that's where you run into issues.
Agreed.
And, you know, we could give examples on, you know, what would this actually look like? Mm-hmm. Or, for example, I think we were talking earlier, I don't think this is in our paper, but you gave me the example of somebody who makes a chair. Right.
Yeah.
So like a chair.
Work a co-op, makes chairs. Yeah. For some reason, I always think of chairs.
I love it. Like there's, yeah. So, right. Say, for example, I'm a co-op entity. I supply goods and service. I make chairs. Mm-hmm. And say, for example, my neighbor wants to buy a chair, but maybe he doesn't know any co-ops. He doesn't know me, maybe, that mm-hmm. make chairs, and he wants to support a worker or owned organization. Mm-hmm. So he goes online and plugs into the DLT co-op network and finds out, oh, great. You know, this place real nearby makes chairs. And then he submits a request to have a chair made. Mm-hmm. And then that request would get entered into our distributed ledger. Mm-hmm. And so we have now a token issuing entity, or it could be an exchange, that receives that confirmation of the purchase and then issues something like a receipt token mm-hmm. to that person's wallet.
Maybe like an NFT, maybe.
Yeah. Essentially, it's a receipt of purchase. Mm-hmm. And then once that happens, the smart contract gets automatically implemented to generate a service order mm-hmm. right, that's then received by the cooperative, and that co-op can start making the chair. Right? Mm-hmm. And then the funds received by the exchange from the individual would get automatically deposited into the co-op's account. And then those could potentially get redistributed into different sub-accounts that have mm-hmm. different purposes, right? We talked about a savings fund, operations right. fund, emergency fund, retirement, whatever you mm-hmm. need. And then that's all decided by co-op members.
Right.
And then supporting this, right, the idea about the credit unions utilizing, you know, the proper accounting technology, that would be preferred.
Right.
And then finally, once I'm done making the chair, it's constructed, we deliver it to the participant, then his receipt token is returned and it mm-hmm. gets recirculated in order to maintain kind of price stability right. and, you know, clarity in accounting. Mm-hmm. But what you were talking about before is where could this go wrong?
Right.
So I think one of the things we have to be cautious about is resisting fully automating all interactions and leave room for negotiation or flexibility. So say, for example, my neighbor in this example, he puts in an order for a chair mm-hmm. on the ledger. He's wanted a chair for a really long time, but before the co-op can finish making it, the next day, his daughter comes over and surprises mm-hmm. him with a brand new chair for his birthday.
Right? Oh boy.
Now, because blockchain transactions are irreversible, we have to figure out how to return the token and refund the fiat cash that the participant spent, or right. maybe he exchanged other crypto. I don't know. But you got to figure out how to refund the stablecoin that he mm-hmm. used to purchase the chair in the first place.
That's that flexibility you were talking about.
Yeah,
that has
exactly.
to be there.
Mm-hmm. And so then you have to trust the exchange and the co-op that are receiving the funds that they're going to comply, because mm-hmm. once it's on there, and if you don't build in that flexibility, especially on the smart contract for reversibility, they could hold the funds hostage technically. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Or it's even more insidious. You could say if a competitor tries to hack the system, right? Somebody from a competing company comes in and kind of makes some fraudulent transactions. If those can't be reversed, right? And currency exchanges can and have been hacked before yep. and continue to do so.
Yep.
Your network is only as secure as your programmers can make it. And mm-hmm. any network, whether it's blockchain or otherwise, it's subject to human failure, right? So, you know, you need to have increased data security reviews happen regularly in these types of projects. So ultimately, what we've been talking about is that blockchain is not a trustless technology, right? No, yeah. no technology is ever really trustless. You're still placing trust in the people at the other end of the computer or the smartphone. And as long as you're aware of that, that's okay. And that's why we would recommend that for any co-op that's interested in distributed ledgers, you resist that. That impulse to computationally automate everything 100%. You need to leave a little room for messiness and for yeah. flexibility and hybridization. And I think ultimately you have to leave room for what makes cooperatives successful in the first place, right?
Agreed. 100% agreed. You know, with the time that we have left, I would like to just maybe dive in with you on more, broader concepts. Like, could you tell us exactly from your point of view, you know, using your research, where do you think we're headed in terms of blockchain policy? And where do you see us maybe in the next 5 years or something like that? And what's that environment look like as from the point of view of what we're talking about, do you think that these ideas will start to be implemented more and more over time? Or do you think that this is just really something up to the people that really have to push it forward?
Right. Yeah, it's tricky because in terms of tech development, of course, the people with the capital are leading the conversations already. So mm-hmm. it does take a lot of time and perhaps funding that is hard to get for people who are coming at this from a more equitable lens in terms of implementing cooperative structures mm-hmm. with blockchains. But there are a number of organizations that are doing this already and really aiming to connect broader global audiences who are interested in this from a kind of left perspective. Mm-hmm. One of those areas, one of those movements is DISCO, or the Distributed Cooperative Organization, and that mm-hmm. leverages principles from Eleanor Ostrom's Principles of the Commons, cooperative principles, peer-to-peer right. movement. And this is getting some traction from a wider range of folks, usually a lot of young folks who are just frustrated with the way that tech monopolies are working now. We saw it as well with distributed social media networks, with the recent acquisition of Twitter. Mm-hmm. We see people moving to Mastodon, which mm-hmm. is technically a distributed social media platform. Yep. So technically, blockchain based. And it's just that the kind of user interface of some of these tools needs a little bit of polishing. But I think once more eyes are brought to it, more kind of development happens, we could make some real progress. I think that with mm-hmm. these broad conceptual movements like the DISCO, they're mm-hmm. catchy. They have a lot of buzz to them. But it also runs into the issue where there's a lack of specificity towards localized legal nuances that make it hard for people to grapple with on the ground and make it a little bit difficult to implement. Right. And so that's why selfishly I would say that I would hope that policymakers take more stock in folks who are doing kind of empirically cited research mm-hmm. around the behavior around people engaging in blockchains to kind of understand the technology behind just the unchecked claims or the rhetoric, right? What do we actually yep. mean by this when we say trustless, when we say decentralized, et cetera? And specifically, how can it work? How can it be implemented on the ground? Because what works in one case or one context is not necessarily transferable. It's not always going to work another place. Yes, we can learn from case studies in other locations, and that's always helpful. But again, it's fairly new. But the more case studies that we can pull from and learn from, pros and cons, the better equipped we are to sandbox in a more equitable way moving forward.
Perfect. And just to finish off, the fact is that you're not an attorney, but sometimes I feel like we need people that aren't attorneys to give us different points of view so that us that practice the law can start to take those things into account whenever we sit down and maybe have the opportunity to affect the law in an actual way. So don't be shy. Tell us attorneys what we need to do or what we should be thinking about whenever we come and approach the subject from your point of view, where you can consider other things that aren't just the black letter law. What should we, take into right. account from your point of view?
Yeah. Well, I'm a fan of cooperation. I'm mm-hmm. a big fan of intellectual cooperation. Mm-hmm. And I think that the more diverse people that you can get sitting around a table, having a conversation, having a dialogue with each mm-hmm. other, the better. Because everybody is an expert in their own right, in their own field, or their own way of life. And so I think especially learning from folks who are skeptical of this technology, mm-hmm. and why they're skeptical, and rightly so, learning from people in different academic fields and different fields of practice, I think, really I'm a fan of this kind of diversified body of knowledge that we can build together. Mm-hmm. And and maybe talk less to tech developers in a way that if not all of them do this, but you can often tell when somebody's trying to pitch a product to you or sell a product. And that's the biggest red flag for me. I can spot it a mile away. And it doesn't mean that those products are bad in any way. But again, it's coming to policy from a kind of lobbying perspective, or, you know, these laws should get passed because it's favorable for me or my product that I'm trying to sell. That's the biggest red flag that I would warn anybody around. I do think that those conversations are still really useful to have. And I love speaking with tech developers as an academic, because it helps me learn too what people's ideas and perspectives are. So
we certainly see the value in having different voices onto our podcast. And we know that our listeners mostly are going to be people that practice the law, people that are attorneys. But what you just said is incredibly important, which is we have to listen to other voices, other academics, other points of view that aren't just purely the legal point of view, and take that into account. Because, you know, like it or not, attorneys are usually the ones that are sitting down in those spaces that end up being where policy gets developed.
Yes, so, and you're making the real change here. So that's the important thing. Yeah. So I could write as many papers as I want, but it's not necessarily going to make any legal difference.
No, I think that we're all just cooperating, to use a term that we've thrown around pretty much all the time in this in this episode. We're all cooperating in that. So thank you for cooperating with us, giving us some of your valuable time, and making our podcast that much more intellectually diverse.
Thank you so much for the invite. This has really been a blast.
Thanks so much, Julian. Take care.
All right.